Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Please welcome James Toback. Thank you very much, David. And the only thing I'll say before, say a little bit before, because actually Fingers is a rather numbing film. And usually it's, I think, with these setups, it's better to do the talking afterward. But I find that, when Fingers first came out, there were a lot of people who wanted to castrate me when the movie was over. In fact, there was a screening at Arthur Knight's class at USC Film School before the movie opened, and this sort of angelic-looking girl walked towards me after it was over as I was sitting there with Arthur Knight, and I thought to myself, what a sweet and lovely face this girl has. I wonder what odd compliment she's going to give me. And she stood there trembling, and I thought, how touching. Look how nervous she is before saying what she has to say. And then she said, I just want to say one thing, and then I'm going to leave. I am not a violent person, but I would like to take a kitchen knife and stick it in your face. And Arthur Knight, who was this kind of austere, elderly gentleman, who actually made me squeamish about swearing when I was around him, looked as if he were going to fall off his chair and die. I mean, he turned beet red, and he sort of fumbled an apology. I said, well, there's no need to apologize. Obviously, the movie didn't agree with her. But the overall effect usually is actually to make people, whether they respond the way she did or more generously, is to not to want to talk or to feel somewhat wordless. So anyway, I'll just say a couple of general things now, and then whoever does want to ask questions afterward, obviously, be happy to answer them. But I had never directed a movie before I directed Fingers. But I had written one, The Gamble, with Jimmy Kahn and Lauren Hutton, which Carol Rice directed, and I was around that film all the time, but I'd never studied film at all. I'd never studied directing. I really knew nothing about how to make a movie. And I said to Carol Rice, do you mind, since you're going to use me, which he did for both rewriting and general advice in a world he didn't know well, without my getting any extra money for it, do you mind if I use this occasion to educate myself? He said, no, feel free. I said, well, I don't mean just casually. I mean, will you tell everybody that he or she is supposed to answer whatever questions I have? They sort of look at me and say, well, we are making a movie. It might impinge on certain people's functions to say that you always have to snap to attention if Jim has a question about how to do something. He said, but within reason. And that, I did actually use it for that purpose. And then what happened was I wrote this script for Fingers, and it read, unlike Vicky and unlike Bugsy and unlike most of my other scripts, The Pickup Artist, like a completely inaccessible, obscene, semi-pornographic movie, to the point where everybody who read it first said, well, this is a kind of hardcore X, right? And I never thought of it that way, and I knew that it wasn't really, but it read that way. I mean, there's quite a bit of dialogue in which you see it on the page. I was getting absolutely nowhere in getting it financed, and, you know, very few people want to take a shot with a first-time director anyway. But with a script like that, and with a cast which was totally uninteresting to anybody, Harvey Keitel at the time was not in demand at all as a leading man. Jim Brown had done some action films, but you weren't. This movie like this, forget it. Tisa Farrow had been driving a cab and working as a bartender. So it was not a cast that was going to draw anyone. And Danny Aiello, no one had heard of at the time. So that wasn't going to help. And on the other hand, I just said, well, this is what I want to do. I'm going to hang with it. Then one day I saw I saw George Barry, who ran Fabergé, with Florence Davis, Miles Davis' ex-wife, thought that he looked like a rather unconventional perfume guy. And to make a long story short, got him to finance the movie. Nobody else would have. And everybody at Fabergé tried to keep him from doing it, as you'll see when you see the movie. It's not a movie that looks to be the film financed by a perfume company. And then when it was done, met with tremendous adversity. There were a few people who really hooked into it and were crusaders for it. And then once it got to Europe, Truffaut and Fassbinder in particular, and Daniel Schmidt and some other directors really got behind it and did a great deal for it. When it first opened here, Vincent Canby and Janet Maslin, as an entry, really tried to kill the movie. I mean, it was a kind of conscious effort to see that the movie closed and vanished. And there were quite a few people who sort of took their cue from them. So it had a very, very rough beginning. And it sort of has taken about 10 or 15 years for it to get out there around the world. And it's now doing that. But anyway, it's still going to be a sort of rugged movie to talk about afterward. This is all I'll say for now. And those of you who wish to remain and not try to get me with a kitchen knife, I'll talk.
This film was very controversial, as we talked about at the time it came out, and it's both in terms of violence and sexual transgressiveness, it's provocative, but there certainly were more violent films out around the time. So, was it some of the sexually transgressive scenes that caused the most controversy?
I think that it was a combination of things. One, there was, by any conventional way of looking at it, no redeeming social value. It wasn't that it presented what it presented in any context of conventional hopefulness or decency or, Taxi Driver, for instance, was a kind of morality tale and had a very happy ending, which was tacked on after originally having been written in a very cold and dark way. This didn't, and also, I think a number of people, there were a couple of what I called walkout scenes, exit scenes. And one of them is the scene with Jim Brown. And at the moment that he bangs the two girls' heads together, a lot of people, Richard Jordan, who is now dead, a very good actor, and his then wife or girlfriend, Blair Brown, also a good actress, were sitting next to each other. They both later became friends of mine. I didn't know them at the time. But they were sitting at Cinema 2, and when that happened, Richard Jordan howled with laughter. He found it funny, which not many people did. There were other occasionally. Blair Brown punched him and said, "If you find that funny, I don't want to be with you," and walked out of the theater, and then told him she thought the whole movie was disgusting because of that. Anyway, I saw it at an airport not long after that. I had met Jordan by then, and he told me this story, and I went up to her and I said, "I just want to introduce myself to you because you're one of my biggest admirers." And she said, "Well, who are you?" I said, "Jim Toback." She blushed. Anyway, we became friends. But my point is that scene, a lot of people took to be an expression of, in some way, my way of looking at the world, or that there was some sense of approval. And that had to do with, there was an awareness at the time it was written about, that I had lived with Jim Brown for 2 years and been very friendly with him, and he had been arrested for doing that 6 times for that very thing. In fact, that's what gave me the idea to do it, and because it kind of haunted me. And I think that, John Simon went on television and said that I was encouraging people to do this by approving and stuff. And often, people confuse the... It's this idea that if something's on screen, you are advocating it. And the whole idea of presenting a character you can root for, sympathize with, at least. But even now, that phrase is everywhere in movie making. Who are we supposed to root for? Who are we supposed to identify with? So I think for a lot of those reasons, this movie, and then also it's perception when something comes out. A movie of this kind needs big support from a lot of places to have a shot. And this movie got very little support and a huge amount of rage. I mean, about 6 or 7 years ago, somebody sent me all the stuff that had been written about Fingers. He's a Fingers fanatic from the Philippines. And he had sent me a letter saying that he knew the movie by heart and all of a sudden just wanted to introduce himself and that he'd saved everything that had been written about it. And I didn't have anything that had been written about it. So I wrote him back and I said, if you want to Xerox everything you have of this, I'd like to see it. I'm curious because I remember it being quite vicious, but I'd like to get... He sent me this huge dossier from around the world. I mean, the Australian reviews and the Dutch reviews translated. I mean, it was everything. And I looked at some of the stuff in New York, and it was mind-boggling. And it pretty much killed it. I mean, you can't open a movie at Cinema 2 and have... The New York Times write three long articles about what a vile and despicable movie this is and how you should die before you see it. And then New York Magazine and just about everybody in the sort of New York, in that, the very people you needed to, in the Village Voice, the very people I was interested to see, because they said here, this, you know, like James Todd brings his cult classic to the thing, you know, the Voice fucking tried to run it off the planet, you know. So, by the way, Vincent Canby, I gotta just tell you one funny thing about this. Vincent Canby, who really was just, it was like 30 paragraphs of venom on this movie that opened at one theater, 200-seat theater. And 3 years later, I came out with a movie called Love and Money, and his whole review was bemoaning that I'd lost the intensity I had in Fingers in Love and Money.
Well, in your script for Vicky, which was, I guess, written before this, you have Vicky saying, you're nothing, and this is set in the 19th century, but she's saying, you're really nothing until you've been attacked by the New York Times.
So, right, yeah.
Were you surprised at the Times' reaction?
I wasn't, because they had done the same thing to me in The Gambler with Jimmy Kahn and Lauren Hutton. What happened was, Penelope Gilliatt, who was living with Vincent Canby, and was a screenwriter herself and a film critic for The New Yorker, and a kind of very sort of sad, pathetic drunk, had one night slobbered all over herself at Elaine's at a table in a really embarrassing way, and she was constantly sort of interrupting, and I was trying to talk to a friend of mine. So.
We always have questions from the audience, and we've only had two questions so far. Okay. Please, you'll have your time.
This is like okay. The original screenings of things. So what happened was, I heard, you know, from that Canby had it in for me, and I told Carol, because I was unpleasant with Penelope that night. And Carol Rice said, don't worry about it, she's a friend of mine from England, and she's very kind to all my movies, and I, after all, directed this movie, so I'm sure she'll be very kind. He not only eviscerated the movie, he went after me and half. So there are these vendettas that go on, and they're very petty, and they're very intense, and they can be very long-term, and they can be very destructive. And particularly if you're making movies, people always say, oh, it doesn't matter, movies succeed, reviews don't matter. They don't matter too much if the movie is a racer, a movie that everybody sort of knows in advance is going to be bad because the word is out. But it doesn't matter. The movie you're going to spend $30 million is going to get out. But if you take a small movie and you get nasty, angry reviews, forget it. Canby killed one of Antonioni's last films. It was supposed to open. Dan Talbot canceled the whole opening. Never opened in New York because he saw it was an early response. He just said, can't show it. If I don't have a good review from the New York Times, I'm not going to book it.
This was independently produced. What was the distribution of Fingers like? I mean, how many screens
were there? That was the other problem. It was distributed by Brut, which was a perfume company, and they had never distributed anything before. They had a deal with Fox that had just run out, so George Barry said, I know how to distribute. I'll distribute the movie. So it opened in, I think, 200 theaters, and it played for about 2 or 3 weeks in most of them and vanished. Roger Ebert, who did love the movie and was very good about it from the beginning, told me that in Chicago it was the second film on a
double bill with a movie called Drum with Ken Norton. The thing for Drum was Mandingo lit the fuse, Drum is the explosion. And on the marquee it said, Ken Norton is Drum, Jim Brown is Fingers. So that's how it opened in Chicago.
Did Harvey Keitel, could you talk about getting him to do the role and how he felt about seeing the script, his reaction to the script?
That was kind of a funny thing. I had been very friendly with Bob De Niro, who had wanted to play the gambler, and then Carol Rice decided to use Jimmy Kahn instead, which turned out okay, but I had been upset, and Bobby was very upset. And I think sort of held it against me because I went to him first about doing Fingers, and he kind of delayed and delayed and delayed and delayed. And he and Harvey were best friends. And I had never met Harvey, but I liked him a lot in Mean Streets. And I finally said to Bob, you know, this is silly. You know, if you don't want to jump in, I really actually want to go to Harvey because I think he'd be very good too. He said, well, give me another week. And I said, okay. And then another week. He said, just give me another week. I said, now I'm going to go to Harvey. And paradoxically, this was in the pole lounge of the Beverly Hills Hotel, we had this conversation. That day later, there was Harvey Keitel sitting with Jack Clayton, whom I knew through Carol Rice, British director. And I said to Jack afterward, can you introduce me to Harvey? And he said, sure. And Harvey had gone out of the room, came back, did. And I said to Harvey, listen, I was just going to try to find out where to reach you because I want to offer you a part in this movie that I'm doing. And I said, I'm up in room 207. Why don't you come up there when you're done with with talking to Jack? So he did, and I said to him, we talked, was sort of friendly for 5 or 10 minutes, and then I said, listen, this is the movie of your life, and it's going to change your life, and I want you to commit right now to doing it. And he said, well, do you mind if I read the script first? And I said, actually, I do. I think that part of the way this should be done is that you should commit to doing it before you read the script, just off the awareness that we have some connection together. He said, I think I'd really prefer to read the script first. I just can't. So we argued about that for about 10 minutes. And then he said, okay, why don't we say this? I'll commit to doing it, but I also want to read it. And I'll speak to you tomorrow after I read it. So I said, okay, and gave him the script. And then the next day, we pretty much agreed to do it. It happened rather fast. What didn't happen fast was the financing, because I said there was really no way of getting it, and early or easy. The only odd way I could have gotten it, and I resisted the temptation, was Ricky Nelson, who actually was a very bright and nice and crazy guy of Ozzy and Harriet fame and rock and roll fame, came up to the room one day and said, his agent had given him the script, and he said, I just want you to know, I am Jimmy Angelelli. So I said, really? He said, yes. And I said, well, I always had a mad crush on you when I was a kid, watching you on Ozzy and Harriet, and I like your singing, but I don't think this is really for you. I'm going to use this guy, Harvey Keitel. He said, well, I can get this movie financed, so if you can't get the money with Harvey Keitel, then get it with me. And I actually, for when things look bleak, occasionally would think about it, but then we finally got it.
Okay. Is there anybody in the audience with a question? Okay, start right here.
I saw the film when it first opened in 1978, and I was really impressed by it. And one of the things that I really liked about the lust is in the air throughout the entire film, the scene with the man looking at him in the bar, and the scene with the little girl looking at him near the pier. I just really like that, and I would like you to talk a little bit more about that.
Well, that's extreme. You were right in my unconscious, and actually in earlier drafts of the script, because in the first several drafts of the script, really right up until the end, and Harvey objected to my taking it out, there was a very violent homosexual scene in the movie. Because the whole movie, it seems to me, is about a guy who has not figured out whether he is a dick or an asshole. That is to say, he does not know which end is which, and his father is looming over him as this sort of colossal dick that he hasn't been able to escape from, which is the irony of the father saying to him, what are you trying to do, stick your prick up my ass, when that's what he's been doing to his son his whole life. But what happened was that scene in the bar involved a lot of look exchanges, and afterward Harvey went up and was drawn in and went up to an apartment with three of the guys, and it became I don't want to say pleasantly sexual, I'd say agreeably sexual, and then all of a sudden Harvey flipped and became very violent. This was in an earlier draft, and the scene became very brutal. And it was Harvey's favorite scene in the movie. And I can't honestly remember why I felt it would derail the movie, but at the last minute I took it out. And Harvey really was angry. He felt that it was a scene that was needed. And up till a couple of years ago, used to say to me, we should have done that scene, we should have had that scene. And the other one you talked about came out of nowhere. It wasn't written in. That little girl was not written in. But I always felt the scene needed something that it didn't have. And the night before we were going to shoot it, I was in McDonald's, 11 o'clock at night on 3rd Avenue in the 80s, and I see this beautiful little 7-year-old girl. And I, all of a sudden it hit me, she ought to be in that scene tomorrow. So I went up to her and I said, may I speak to your mother? Because I want to talk to you about being in a movie tomorrow that I'm shooting. And she said, is Joe Namath in it? And I said... I said, no, but Ed Marinaro's in it. It was playing for the Jets at the time. She said, I don't like Ed Marinaro as much as Joe Namath. I said, well, I can't help that. But I said, I would love to talk to him. Where is your mother? So she said, I don't know. I said, well, whom are you with here? She said, I'm here alone. And I said, how old are you? And she said, 7. And I said, well, I said, do you usually come to McDonald's at 11 o'clock at night? She said, yeah. So we took a walk together, and I told her about the movie. Eventually, we were going to go back to her apartment, which she had the key to, and her mother was going to be there eventually, she said. We ended up going into Central Park. It was in the summer. And it was no, it was the winter actually. But we went into Central Park, and there was a kind of intimate series of things going on in the bushes. And I sort of steered her away, and she said, "Look at those people." But anyway, we ended up going up to this apartment that she had in Sutton Place. And around 4 in the morning, her mother staggered in, and she had a late date. And here she sees this strange man sitting with her 7-year-old daughter. And I said, listen, I know it's odd for me to be here, but, you know, she said, really, you want to use it in the movie? She said, is there a part for me too? So anyway, that's how it happened. And then a year later, I saw on David Susskind. David Susskind is talking to the different kids about how they got their start. So he says to Tina, and how did you get your start? She said, well, I was sitting in McDonald's at 11 o'clock at night, and this director, James Toback, came up to me and said, come here, I want to talk to you. And by the time she had finished this story, said, I want to use you in a movie, I sounded like somebody that you would want incarcerated before the show was over. And David Susskind pumped that up. He kept saying, now, say this again. He came up to you at 11 o'clock at night, and he walked you into Central Park, and then... Anyway, I don't know what's happened to her, but she was very precocious.
Okay.
I have two questions. Who were the champions in the United States?
Yeah. Who were the champions of the film, the critics who supported the film when it came out?
Roger Ebert, Gene Siskel, Pauline Kael, I wouldn't call a champion, but she had she sort of called attention to it. David Thompson, by far the most important and the best, who, by the way, if you don't know his work, is the best writer about film, I think, by far in the last 30 years in the world, and has a book out called The Biographical Dictionary of Film, which is the best one-volume book about movies, and a terrific book about Orson Welles that just came out called Rosebud. In any event, David Thompson, who wrote at the time for an alternative paper in Boston called The Real Paper, which is now defunct, but he wrote a lengthy and really brilliant essay on Fingers. And I would say that that's pretty much the nucleus of it. Charles Champlin in the LA Times actually wrote an extremely intelligent and passionate piece about it, but hedged and said a lot of people will find this movie outrageous and disgusting. So, you know, but it was, those were the nucleus, and there were about 50 people who were just furious. And John Simon actually implied that I was fucking Pauline Kael, and that's why she wrote what she did about the movie, and then said it at UCLA at a big gathering they had, they asked me about it on a TV interview after that, and I said, I have fucked Pauline Kael the same number of times I fucked John Simon. So,
Secondly, can you just say anything about any influences on the film or on any of your other films?
You mean who influenced me?
Yeah.
I am too megalomaniacal to admit to myself that I'm influenced by anybody. I'm sure I am, but I hate a lot of people consciously borrow all the time. I would not ever do that. I can't imagine that Orson Welles' love of wide-angle lenses did not influence me, because the first thing I ever noticed stylistically about movies was the wide-angle lenses in Orson Welles' movies. And I read Andre Bazin about that, and I heard Welles talk about wide-angle lenses, and it struck me that there was a whole philosophical justification that one could make for using wide-angle lenses, and that it was in harmony with what I wanted to do cinematically anyway. So I'm sure that, and in particular Touch of Evil, definitely had an influence. But most of my movies, and certainly Fingers, are coming very much from raw personal experience. I studied the piano. I know the gambling world inside out. I lived with Jim Brown for 2 years in his house. So, and I usually develop some kind of personal rapport, a connection with the actors I'm dealing with, so that I'm not only having them play a role, I'm using things about them that I know in the movie. As I said, in the case of Jim, it was rather egregious, because he had been arrested 6 times for exactly this one act. I was a bit squeamish about suggesting that he do it in the movie, but he went with it, and even though I think he knew it would certainly not help his career or image at all.
Okay. Doesn't this movie promote violence, that people see movies like this and pick it up and then follow the example of Crime Goes Up for movies like this? There's now an organization that's...
Sir, I think you have a question.
No, I didn't. There's an organization that's called Fairness and Accuracy in Media that is promoting a different outlook on television and the others that are...
Well, unfortunately or fortunately... not enough people saw Fingers for it to influence anybody. But yeah. Yeah, okay. Yeah. it's nice to see that the movie can still elicit some of what it did when it originally came out. Except that used to be the majority response to the movie. I was up at Harvard with the movie and got the best response I'd had, and the next night I was in Dartmouth. And David Thompson, in fact, who I just mentioned, was the head of the film department then, and he did put it on a bit thick. He could tell the audience didn't like it, since they hissed wildly when the movie ended. Then he said that anyone who didn't understand that this was a great movie really didn't know anything about film, and that 20 years from now, everybody there would realize this was a great movie. And here he is, James Toback. So if it wasn't bad enough, it's not only did you not like the movie, you're assholes for not liking it, and I came out. And I actually thought I was in physical danger, because the questions were uniformly starting with phrases like, where do you come off with, and who do you... It was a really... And I was supposed to say overnight in this little motel in Dartmouth that had no security, and I said, forget it. I don't care. And I rented a car and drove around all night just to get out of Hanover. And there are obviously cases where people see things on the screen and then they decide to do them. To do them in exactly the way they were done on screen. I don't think that in the long run you can make a case, one can make a case for the censorship that would entail, because it finally comes down to censorship, because unless you make things illegal, they're going to happen cinematically. And I think that's just part of all free speech, in the same way that when one talks publicly and says certain things, it's incendiary. I mean, for instance, I happen to know Louis Farrakhan very well. I knew him when he was around Jim Brown's house. He was one of Jim's best friends. But suppose Farrakhan says something about Jews, and then the next day, some guy who believes in him and follows him sees some Jew on television and doesn't like him and goes to the studio and stabs him on the street afterward. Now, are you going to say that Farrakhan is not allowed to say even things that might be interpreted as totally bigoted on television? Once you let the gates open, I think it's all over. You have lost all free speech. And if movies affect people and they cause them to fuck a dog, then they cause them to fuck a dog. If they cause them to kill, they cause them to kill. I don't believe that's usually true. But I don't take the position that that's never true. Oliver Stone always says violence existed long before movies did. That's true, but that's also evasive of the issue. There are cases where people see a movie and decide that they're going to do what is done on the screen, whether it's of a violent or sexual nature. It probably is more often violent or sexual than it is anything else, because those are the things that have the greatest impact. But I think it's ultimately, you can make no case in any kind of freedom of speech oriented society for saying you can't use that, or you have a responsibility not to put that kind of stuff in movies. And I think Dole and Clinton together are pandering, repressive, censor-loving, and Paul Simon, too. I think the whole political establishment in this regard is cowardly and intellectually unserious in the way they deal with the issue.
What do you think has happened to the climate? One of the things that David Thompson said while praising the movie Fingers was that it was going to be hard for you to continue to make movies like this. And just your experience, certainly you had a very acclaimed movie with Bugsy, but it's a different kind of movie. What has been your experience dealing with this sort of material since the 1970s in Hollywood, and how has Hollywood changed?
Even George Barry wouldn't finance this movie today. This movie could get financed nowhere by anybody now. If Scorsese took this script with De Niro, he could not get it financed. There is no way anyone could get this movie financed with any cast. They would just say, reading this script, forget it. Make anything else you want, don't make this. So I think that, you know, I was lucky that I came along at a time where there was at least some openness to this. I think that it's gotten worse and worse and worse. It's going to continue to get worse and worse and worse for doing any movie like this. The only answer to that is to do movies very, very inexpensively and very small. And that's why I did The Big Bang the way I did. Not because I could have done that expensively. It was designed to be done small. But I was so tired of trying to do movies I wanted to do and finding no way of doing them. I'm almost in that situation again now. I've been spending months and months trying to get Harvard Man set up. Haven't been able to yet officially. There is another movie that I've written in the last 3 weeks called Two Girls and a Guy, which I can shoot for 10 days for under $1 million, which I will do if I have to do because I'm getting so frustrated and impatient about the other thing. But that's really the answer, I think, to do it so that it isn't an economic burden. Although, even at a low budget, people don't want to finance movies that are strange or like, because they still say, well, we have to distribute, and just distribute a movie now and you make any real money, the cost is big.
Okay, you've been waiting down in front here.
First of all, I thought the movie seemed relatively tame compared to what I've seen on the screen. But you mentioned a scene that had been taken out. Had that been shot already?
No, just I took it out of the script. By the way, tame in terms of graphic violence and sex, absolutely. It's not tame emotionally, and that's what bothered people, I think. Because if you portray violence or sex in a way that is not real at all, which is what is usually the case, I mean, in these sort of big movies, you see people beheaded, you see veins pulsating, but you do not hear somebody talking about the texture of somebody's pussy. And you hear a use of a word, but the psychology of that stuff, or a father saying to a son, what are you trying to do, stick your prick up my ass? When things approach emotional seriousness, they are far less digestible to people financing movies when there's some distance from them.
The question I have is, how many scenes that you shot were trimmed in order to...
Nothing. Every setup is on the screen. We shot the movie in 19 days, and every setup is on the screen. No, I did a lot of tight editing at the last minute in order to... In order not to waste any time, and there every setup is on the screen, and the editing process was really one of just trimming and choosing takes.
Was every scene shot as written? I mean, this was your first film as a director, and it feels to the viewer like it might have improvisation or.
There is not a syllable that was not written. It's totally unimprovised. The only variety from take to take was in performance, but not in language. When you want to do a movie in 19 days like this, you really have to get it down so tight. And it was very rigorously rehearsed, and with Mike Chapman as the cameraman, very carefully staged. So we really knew exactly what we were going to do. Because it was winter, we had short days, and it was 19 days, and we were shooting all over the city. So, and a lot of very raw stuff, and a lot of actors who were not really professional. Several people were doing this as their first movie, so it really we had to be very well prepared.
What was your personal impetus to creating this film? What did you? The other half is, what did you want people to experience, and why?
I think it was you know, I start always with a character, a central character, and who interests me, and I'm saying, what does he do? Okay, this guy is frustrated concert pianist, and he works for his father, and he has who's a Shylock and bookmaker, and he has two parents coming from different worlds. So that was the kind of premise. What does his life revolve around? It revolves around music and a desire to find out who he is sexually, and a provocation of death, a kind of interest in dangerous situations. So I start making certain, drawing certain inferences about a character as if he really exists without my having created him. And the more I ask questions about what he would like and what he would do and what he would be interested in, the film starts to take shape. After the fact, I can say that all of my movies are dealing with characters who are sexually obsessed, romantically obsessed, have a nose for tension and danger and physical violence, and who are on some kind of quasi-suicidal course. So, but that isn't that I consciously set out to do that. It's just after making movie after movie that deals with that, I have to admit that that must be what I'm looking to convey.
And is it cathartic? Do it and see. I mean, it's negative in a, you know, moral sense, but personally, you know, is it
Absolutely, and in fact, I get very depressed by movies that have happy endings, and that appear to be giving some kind of hopeful message, because after all, it's very easy for the people on the screen to tell you that they're usually doing much better than you are in life, and I get rather nauseous at these kind of. Jingoistic, and I don't just mean that nationalistically, I mean emotionally jingoistic movies that sort of say everything's going to be okay, just hang in there, you know, keep your dreams, keep plugging, you know, and suck my dick, you know, I mean, it's like I just get sick at movies like that from the time I was a little kid, and movies that sort of said things are not all right, and they're not going to be all right, and life is unnerving and disquieting and ultimately tragic. Then I felt I was being told the truth, because in fact the fundamental reality for all of us is we are either going to die suddenly and shockingly when we don't expect to, or we're going to die a rather painful and miserable and debilitating and humiliating death, one or the other. And so is everybody else that we care about. So what kind of cheery news is that, you know? And it's not as if all the movies are telling us that all the time. Most of the movies are lying to us and pretending that that isn't true. So I think in a way they cheat you and they make you feeble and less able to handle that stuff. And to me, a moral movie is a movie that gives you some kind of strength to deal with the adversity of life in an honest way, and not to feed you some kind of pabulum that you pay $8 to get, and they get enriched, and you go off and continue to suffer.
The Gambler was a terrific film. I really enjoyed very much. I was wondering why the studio never released the soundtrack. Beautiful music in that movie.
I'll tell you why. For the same reason that they never promoted the movie properly, Frank Yablons, this is part of studio politics with a lot of movies that have come out, was the head of Paramount when the movie was given the go and when it was shot. And he was 100% behind the movie and was making it the big movie for Paramount. He was fired the day before the movie opened. And Barry Diller, who later became a friend of mine whom I like very much, did what all studio heads do when they come in and they dump on the previous guy's pet projects. It's just, unless the movie is going to be such an obvious hit that it's suicidal not to, and self-spiteful not to push it, always you see the rug pulled out from under. And overnight, they canceled about 20% of the theaters. The marketing budget was cut in half. And all the things that ordinarily would have been done weren't done. The movie was just absolutely sabotaged. And the irony, as I say, is that I later became very friendly with Diller. And it wasn't that it was anything personal. It was just that that is what a new guy coming in always does to the movies of his predecessor.
I want to make sure that we talk about Vicky a little bit before we end. So I just want to ask you if you could, and this is the script that's published in the issue of Scenario, and a, really an amazing script that was, I guess you started even before Fingers came out.
Yeah.
Can you just explain kind of briefly what that is and then what the story of...
Well, Victoria Woodhull, who was, I think, about as fascinating a woman who as has lived in America since its inception, was a spiritualist, feminist, free lover, journalist, stockbroker, ran for president, a general wild woman who anticipated practically all notions of the woman's movement in the 19th century, and who lived a bizarre and colorful and exciting life that touched on all these aspects of American life. And the self-same brute pictures, George Barry, Fabergé, thought that this would make a very good movie and probably a perfume tie-in as well. George had loved The Gambler, and he came to me and said, do you want to write this movie? You're not an obvious candidate for it, but I really like your script for The Gambler, and if you can write me that kind of script, this is good for Vicky, we'll make the movie. So I said, sounded good, and I did, and I finished, and he said, now who do you want to have direct it? And I said, I want to direct it, and that was out of the question. It was a very expensive movie, $6 million, which in those days is like about 30 now. Anyway, so well, let's get an actress first. So I went to Faye Dunaway, and Faye, whom I knew, and Faye loved it and was ready and eager, and then she and I decided jointly to go to George Cukor. And George was very much interested and intrigued, and everything was ready. And then we all got along well. We were going to go ahead. And then what happened was the Bluebird opened. I don't know how many of you saw that from Maurice Maeterlinck's play. And it was not only lambasted, it was cruelly and viciously slaughtered by the very people who had always supported George Cukor. In particular, Vincent Canby, the legendary Vincent Canby, who had been a big, big fan of Cukor's, and who, in effect, said in his review, this is a senile, helpless, pathetic has-been who can no longer make a movie. And George Barry said to me and to Faye, I'm sorry, I am not going ahead and putting that kind of money into a movie directed by a senile guy who can't direct a movie anymore. The sad truth was that the Bluebird was not a good movie. So it wasn't as if we could sit there and say, what are you talking about? Just because some assholes don't like the movie doesn't mean it's not good. It looked like a movie that showed a director who had lost all of his capacities. The truth is, George then made several very good movies after that, and we knew, Faye and I, that he really was still at the top of his game because he was still very sharp. He just happened to make a movie that didn't work. He was shooting in Russia. There were a lot of problems. He hated Cecily Tyson, and Cecily Tyson hated him, and that made everything miserable. Ava Gardner was fucking the chauffeur. There were all this stuff that was going on, and he had these tales that were very funny tales. It's just that it didn't work for him. Anyway, that killed the movie, And I sort of hoped it would, you know, revive, and now maybe it will get revived, because the script has always been something that all of us have loved. George always wanted to do it. Faye, to this day, always... She's unfortunately too old now, because there'll never be anyone who would have been as right for the part as she was.
Okay, right here.
How much did Fingers cost to make?
$900,000. Of which a rather generous amount went to Harvey Keitel, Jim Brown, and me, given the budget. I mean, the three of us got a total of $300,000, so the actual below-the-line cost was $600,000.
Okay, right here.
I was just curious about whether the Fingers was like a singularly attached film for these moral reasons. Like, I don't know anything about how Taxi Driver was received.
Much better. Taxi Driver got good reviews.
Taxi Driver had a studio behind it and was well promoted and well distributed and had a happy ending. If Taxi Driver had ended the way it was originally written, I think it would have been half as successful at best. It had a very, very cold, hard, dark ending originally, and instead they tacked on that ending, which let people come out of the theater with something different.
Okay, and last question over here.
Did you make money?
Actually, I made, for those days, a fair amount of money. I never got any residuals from it or profit participation. The movie actually has grossed worldwide now over $6 million, so it's actually returned very well on its original investment, which few people know. And whenever they say, movies that can't make money, but, if you make them for $900,000, they almost can't lose money. And no money was spent distributing it. The movie had an advertising budget of $250,000 total for the whole country. And I said to George, how is anybody going to know it's there if you don't know, if you don't advertise? George Barry. And he said, they'll walk in front of the theater.
Huh.
So I said, is that the way you advertise Fabergé cosmetics? They go in the drugstore and they see it on the shelf.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.